here with us for the morning show as we look at the issue of police residency requirements. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Protests that swept across our country in the wake of George Floyd's death have rekindled the debate over where police live. And some activists want officers to be required to live in the cities they patrol. They argue it will make officers more culturally competent, diversify police forces, and improve community trust. Our partners at Wiscontext, they reached out to 8 cities across the state to request data about the residency status of their police officers. And those cities are Beloit, Green Bay, Kenosha, Madison, Milwaukee, Racine, Waukesha, and Wausau. Should police live where they work? Does it affect the job they do? We're at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is associate editor of Wiscontext. That's the reporting partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Will, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So why did you reach out to these 8 cities?
That's a good question. It all kind of stemmed from the protests following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And an analysis by some publications up in the Twin Cities of residency data in Minneapolis that found that only 8% of police officers who are employed by the city of Minneapolis actually live in the city there.
You said 8%.
8%
live in the city. Wow.
Yep. So that's a really low figure, or we thought so, and I think a lot of people thought so as well. And so we were interested in seeing what the figures are in some of Wisconsin cities, particularly cities that have larger communities of people of color.
And so, you know, were you able to make some generalizations here? Because, you know, 8 cities, they probably have, some differences there. But what did you find?
Yeah, it really ranged quite a bit. And what we found was actually, in some cases, a lingering effect of prior residency requirements. So the state of Wisconsin allowed municipalities and local governments to impose residency requirements for all city employees. Up until 2013, the budget law that was passed that year, signed by former Governor Scott Walker, preempted local government's ability to mandate residency of city employees. In most cases, local governments can still mandate a 15-mile radius for some employees, including police officers, mostly emergency employees, so police officers, firefighters, and EMTs. And then a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision in 2016 settled a legal dispute between the city of Milwaukee and the state about that. So
because Milwaukee wanted to have its officers living in the city?
Exactly. And all its city employees. The city of Milwaukee actually had a residency requirement for 75 years before this preemption law passed. But in 2016, the city of Milwaukee could no longer enforce its residency requirement. We're already seeing the effects of that. We found that the city of Milwaukee actually has, of the 8 cities that you mentioned at the beginning here, that we asked, the city of Milwaukee actually has the highest number of police officers living in the city, and that's just under 50%. And so if all police officers were living in the city when the preemption law was passed not that many years ago, that's a pretty steep decline in Milwaukee. Most other cities that we got data from had residency of police officers ranging from about a third to somewhere in like the 40% range. But the lowest was the city of Racine, just south of Milwaukee, where only 16% of the city's police officers live within city limits.
We're talking with Will Cushman, associate editor of Wiscontext and the author of a new report about police residency in Wisconsin's 8 largest cities. You can join in. What questions do you have about whether police should or should not live where they work? Does it affect the job they do? Does it matter in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. Will, what do community advocates say about why it matters whether police live in the city they work or not?
Advocates say that when a police officer, for instance, In the city of Milwaukee, which is essentially the most racially segregated metropolitan area in the nation, when a police officer lives in the mostly white suburbs or rural areas around Milwaukee, and then is policing quite diverse communities within the city, majority Black or Hispanic communities, it can set up a sort of us versus them mentality, both among the police officers and the communities that they're intended to serve. And that can create a whole number of problems, tension between police and community members, which we've seen a lot of in the last month, and a whole host of other issues that activists see arising from that.
So they say that if the police officer lives and works in the community where they are on their beat, or where at least in the city where they are working, that they will know more about their city and be more inclined perhaps to understand their neighbors and how things work in that city.
Exactly. Yeah, they said they're more likely to know kind of who the local leaders are, local power brokers, but then also just the local residents, and maybe better positioned to more effectively de-escalate conflict between residents and between themselves and residents. So there's really this sense that if police officers are living among the people that they're serving, that they're more likely to feel a kind of more ingrained obligation to that community.
Let's take a call. Nate is with us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Nate.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a comment. I was thinking if police officers were, which I agree, it would be good if police officers lived in the communities they were serving in, but in some larger communities, it is very expensive to live there. So I was thinking maybe they could get a work stipend for housing or something like that, because I think that would be one of the major obstacles to living in the community where you work.
Nate, thank you for bringing that up. I could probably say that it is very expensive to live in Minneapolis, for instance, not in an inexpensive city. What do you see there, Will?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I talked to some police officers, mostly in leadership positions around the state. And they said that that's definitely an issue in some places, potentially Minneapolis, as you mentioned, Kate, but then like other really large coastal cities. New York was brought up by one officer I talked to. But that's probably not a huge issue in most communities in Wisconsin. Some cities have also looked into, for instance, the city of Milwaukee has looked into negotiating some sort of residency incentive with the local police union. So the officers who choose to reside within the city would receive a small pay bump, potentially. That hasn't gone anywhere right now. It's just kind of they're in talks about that right now. Mm. But that's one potential solution.
Well, Cushman is associate editor of WisConText. He analyzed data on where police officers live in 8 cities around the state as the debate over residency requirements has resurfaced. Do you think residency requirements improve relations between officers and the residents they're sworn to protect? Should it matter whether officers reside within 15 miles of the jurisdictional boundaries? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Will Cushman here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring where police officers live. Our partners at WisConText reached out to 8 cities across the state to request data about the residency status of their police officers, and they found that not a single police department employs a force in which even half of its officers live within its jurisdiction. So does that matter? Police associations and unions have argued residency requirements limit the talent pool, that they cause perhaps even corruption. What do you think about residency requirements? Join in 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is associate editor of Wisconsin-Text, and he stays with us. Will, as you reached out to these eight cities and gathered this raw data from departments, were there challenges in interpreting the data?
Yeah, there were for sure. There were even challenges in just receiving the data. So when we reached out to these cities, we asked for just the city name and potentially the zip code for each officer who works for the city. And so there were obvious potential concerns about releasing private information. And so we didn't want the street addresses associated with police officers, and the cities weren't going to provide those anyway. But one issue that arose due to that is that the addressing system in a number of Wisconsin cities, for instance, around Green Bay and Racine, is such that the zip codes and city name that appears on someone's address does not necessarily align with the city where they actually reside. So the data...
Wait, what? Got... How does that work?
Yeah, that was news to me, too. So basically, like, if this was an issue, particularly in the Green Bay area, where I talked to a number of folks with the city there, and they said that there are a number of people who live in suburbs that immediately surround Green Bay. So that would be like Ashwaubenon, Howard, Bellevue, Alloway, who are served by the Green Bay post offices. And have Green Bay zip codes. And so therefore, the city that appears on their actual address is Green Bay, and it's not Ashwaubenon or Alloway or whatever. And actually, the police commander that I interviewed from Green Bay, Kevin Warwick, he actually told me that he himself lives in Ashwaubenon. So he could be potentially among some of those officers who were listed as living in Green Bay, but do live elsewhere. We're not positive how big of an issue that is with the data in some of these cities, but it does kind of raise some questions. And at least the data that we do have, so we show that somewhere around 43% of Green Bay officers have addresses showing that they are in the city of Green Bay. But that's kind of like a ceiling for where that figure could be, because there are a number of officers that we expect actually living in some of the suburbs.
Well, let's take another call. Now, Lynn is with us from Siren. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Good. What do you think about residency requirements for officers?
Well, my father was a Chicago policeman, and Chicago has residency for their Chicago policemen and firemen. And it's been like that for a long time. And, I mean, it was just part of the job. If you wanted to go on to the job, you knew that you had that residency.
And what was that like for you growing up? Did you even think about it? Was it even considered?
Well, we lived in a neighborhood that was mainly Chicago policemen and Chicago firemen.
And so it was really clustered with law enforcement and people who worked for the fire department. Why was that, do you think?
I think it was because it was on the edge of the city and it was a little bit nicer neighborhood.
Lynn, thank you for bringing that story. Will, how would you interpret that Chicago, with its residency requirements, still had first responders clustered together?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I talked to a researcher from the UW School of Business, who does a lot of research on human resources issues in police departments and how various work rules and requirements affect policing outcomes and community policing relationships. And he said that the residency requirements are the effects of them are kind of all over the place. And he said that one effect of them in cities such as Chicago, and we actually see this in Wisconsin as well, in Milwaukee, that's becoming less the case now that its residency requirement has been preempted. But there are neighborhoods that are kind of full of police officers or firefighters and their families, or in some cities, public school teachers, et cetera. And so, yeah, that could create kind of like a similar dynamic that advocates are critical of, in that police officers are choosing to kind of self-segregate into these clusters, into these neighborhoods, and may not be living kind of among the greater community as advocates would like to see. So, I mean, even with residency requirements, you're going to probably in a lot of major cities deal with some of these us versus them issues anyway.
Will, take us back to the city that had the least number of officers living in the city. What did the department tell you?
So that was the city of Racine. And Racine was also a pretty interesting case with its addressing system. So the Racine's data was probably the most, it was actually the most complete of all the data that we got. And it included both the city name of the address associated with all the officers, and along with a notation as to whether or not that address was actually in the city of Racine. And kind of something that was really shocking to me was 48% of officers had Racine addresses, but actually only 16% of officers live within city limits. So there's a whole area around Racine that has Racine addresses that's not actually in the city. And I spoke to the mayor there, Corey Mason, and he said he considers that a big problem, the low number of officers living in the city, especially since the areas around Racine are quite white, and the city of Racine itself is quite diverse and has large Black and Hispanic populations. And he said that they're working on ways to try to increase the ranks of police officers within the city, kind of from the ground up. They're working on potentially like a public safety academy within the local school district. And he describes some other initiatives as well.
So they're trying to kind of start to remedy this, maybe to try to actively recruit more officers from within the city?
Yes. Yeah, that's what he said. It sounds like they're kind of at the early stages of that. But he sounded hopeful that it would at least provide more opportunities for local kids interested in law enforcement careers to pursue that career locally.
Do we have any real notion how police officers feel about these requirements?
Yeah, I spoke with officers' leadership in Madison, Wausau, and Green Bay. And then a colleague at WPR spoke with some in Milwaukee, and none of them are really supportive of residency requirements. In particular, they said it really can hinder recruitment efforts, especially in a metropolitan area where there's a lot of police departments, and some police departments may have a residency requirement and others don't. There's the potential for police departments kind of like poaching each other's officers, increasing competition. And then they just said any type of requirement that tells a prospective applicant that they have to live somewhere is going to cause some people to self-select out of that process.
Is there any notion that even the 15 or 20 miles within the jurisdiction is even that limiting to departments?
Yeah, I spoke with the police chief in Wausau, Ben Bliven, and he said that Wausau does enforce a 20-mile radius requirement, residency requirement. And he said that there have been job applicants who have dropped out after finding out about that requirement up there.
Is there any further steps that you will take with now knowing that this data exists? Is this something you monitor? Where do you go with this content?
That's a really good question. I think we're going to be interested to see how things continue to change in the city of Milwaukee over the coming years. See how the lack of their ability to enforce a residency requirement there continues to change the demographics of their city employees and city residents.
Well, Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Will Cushman is associate editor of WisConText, and you can read his latest story and the entire series on policing practices and accountability in Wisconsin. You can find it at wiscontext.org. Coming up, we talk with a pair of UW-Milwaukee researchers who are tracking the coronavirus through sewage. What do you want to know about the presence of active virus in the wastewater, in the feces? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're learning about why scientists want to monitor sewage for the coronavirus. It's wastewater-based epidemiology here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So researchers around the country and here in Wisconsin have been testing wastewater and feces for the coronavirus. Our sewage, it contains genetic remnants of the active virus, and monitoring it could help predict where the next outbreak will occur. What questions do you have about analyzing wastewater to reduce virus transmission? We're at 800-642-1234. Ryan Newton is an assistant professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Sandra McClellan is here, professor in UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. Sandra, welcome to you.
Thanks for having us on this morning.
Well, Sandra, analyzing sewage for diseases is not a new research method, but it's new for studying the coronavirus. What is going on?
You know, analyzing sewage for viruses like norovirus and some of the enteric viruses has been going on for a number of years. As a matter of fact, the Milwaukee Health Department did it way back in the 90s, and they could show that the seasonal viruses that were going through the community showed up in sewage first. But what's really kind of different about doing the monitoring for the coronavirus is that it's a respiratory virus. So initially, it wasn't real intuitive that we should find it in sewage. But as we started looking and as researchers started digging into this, sure enough, we could track it through sewage. So these efforts are really ramping up now that we see it's a good method to do surveillance.
Yeah, I'm seeing scientific news all over the country and even the world that this is going on and getting samples everywhere. Ryan, how can studying sewage predict future outbreaks?
Well, sewage gives you a sort of snapshot of what's going on in the community. Some of the early research from some countries in Europe showed that in some cases, the sewage levels for the coronavirus were present up to a week before cases started showing up in the clinics or hospitalizations started to spike. So there's some evidence that it could give us an early warning system up to a week ahead of time. So that could give public health professionals an advantage, a little bit of a warning of what's going on in the population before they start seeing cases spike from their individual tests.
So you're saying someone who is asymptomatic, who doesn't realize they have or could spread the virus, but their sewage could tell a different story.
Exactly. Since it captures everybody that's living in the city at once, it gives you a good snapshot of what the whole population is or what's going on in the whole population. It also sort of normalizes for our testing has changed over time, the type of people that we're testing, moving between testing only people who are really sick now to testing more, you know, more widespread. The numbers that we get back from those tests change sort of over time, where sewage gives you that sort of integrated look of the community all at once.
Integrated look, and I would suspect, Sandra, that you could get a much larger snapshot of what is happening in the community in a contrast to like an individual person getting an individual test.
Right. When we look at just, you know, within the Milwaukee metro area, we have a really large, probably one of the larger wastewater conveyance systems going to two plants, one at Jones Island and one at South Shore. So we're getting a picture of, you know, roughly 500,000 people per plant, maybe a little less at one of them. There's no way you can go out and test that many individuals and get that much data all at once. And, you know, as Ryan pointed out, how we have decided to do testing or who's gotten tested has kind of shifted over time. Initially, it was people with, you know, symptoms or the most severe symptoms or people showing up at hospitals. And now as testing becomes more widely available, more people are getting tested. So it's hard to use that number to say, you know, we have 5% positives or 3% positives, because we really, it's not really a random sampling. But when you capture, you know, essentially a snapshot of a million people, and you can do that week after week, now it gives us something to kind of grab hold of and say, all right, what's the trend? What is changing in our city, you know, from week to week as we, you know, either reopen or take different actions?
We're talking with Sandra McClellan, a microbiologist and freshwater researcher. Ryan Newton here as well studies microbial ecology of aquatic ecosystems. We're learning about how scientists are tracking the coronavirus in wastewater and feces with your questions at 800-642-1234. So, Sandra, what do we know about how the virus that causes COVID-19, how that does pass through the body? What happens?
You know, that's a really good question, because that is what has kept, you know, kind of this field of wastewater surveillance from being able to assign an actual number of how many people are sick. The short answer is we don't know how it passes through the body. You know, some people might shed it at high rates. Some people might shed it at low rates. And we also have other ways it can get into the sewage system. Think about brushing your teeth or blowing your nose and you know, flushing that down the toilet. That's another route where viral particles can get into the sewage system. So until we figure out that number, like what people shed and how their behaviors might contribute, we can't really go back and calculate how many people are sick in the community based on the numbers we see at the wastewater treatment plant. But that said, we can certainly follow a trend, and we can match it up to what we're seeing in hospitalizations and, unfortunately, mortality, because those are the numbers that probably won't change. You know, a certain number of people get sick and a certain number of those have very severe outcomes. So if we can match up the sewage numbers to those kind of out trends 2 weeks, that's where we get the early warning, where we can follow it more closely.
Well, let's take a call now. Lori is joining us from Oshkosh this morning. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for having me. I am interested in finding out whether or not Ms. McClellan believes that this can be rolled out to cities and municipal governments and local health departments anytime in the near future before school begins.
Lori, thank you. Sandra?
Lori, thanks for that question. It gives me a chance to really kind of highlight a grant we have through the Department of Health Services in the state of Wisconsin. And they have funded actually doing this kind of surveillance in every county in the state of Wisconsin. So the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene at UW-Madison is leading this grant, and they're doing really many counties throughout Wisconsin. And then our lab is kind of based in the really populated counties where we're already working in Milwaukee, Racine, Brown County, and we're also hoping to work with Waukesha County. So essentially, over the next couple of months, and hopefully before school opens, we'll be gathering data from pretty much every area of Wisconsin and working with the local health departments and through our Department of Health Services to share that data and, you know, and watch those trends.
Ryan, walk us through how you collect samples to analyze this and, you know, for the presence of the virus. Give us the practical guide here, how you're working with this.
Sure, that's a good question. it's not quite as straightforward as just taking a sample from the wastewater treatment plant. Most wastewater treatment plants, especially the larger ones around the country, do regular monitoring of their influent coming into the plant for various reasons, including for regulatory reasons. So they have quite sophisticated technologies to sample those systems. They have automated sampling systems that can take what's a composite sample or a sample over a long period of time. And so typically what we do is set it up to so that they sample over a 24-hour period. So they're getting what's actually called a flow-weighted composite sample. So they weight or composite their sample based on the amount of water coming in to the plant over that 24-hour period, which gives you a good look at what's coming in over a longer period of time. Because any single sample is just a small representation of all the water coming into the plant. It doesn't really represent the entire community. And so in order to get to that, the sampling has to occur over a longer period of time, if possible. So that's where partnering with the wastewater treatment plants is so key. And we've been lucky that we've been partnering with the Milwaukee wastewater treatment plant for a long time. And they really provide us with some really great samples.
And so what happens then inside your lab?
In the lab then, as people probably have heard, this is an RNA virus. So once we have in a sample, we have to get that virus out of the sample. So essentially
there's DNA and there's RNA. So we're talking about the RNA. Okay.
Correct. Yep. So we're going after the RNA. And so we do what's called an RNA extraction or a process to remove all of the RNA out of the water sample, which includes some sort of concentration step, either filtering or a spinning down of the sample. We then extract that RNA. So take the RNA out and purify it. So once you have that purified RNA, that's when the testing can begin.
And when you have the RNA particles from the wastewater, you can then actually sequence the coronavirus genes and see how the strains mutate over time?
Yes, that's totally possible. There's some great efforts out there with now, I think, tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of different strains being sequenced around the world and collected. So people are watching that very closely. So yeah, it's certainly possible to get the RNA and then sequence it to understand what strains are present. It's a little bit trickier when you're talking about a composite sample from lots of people, because those people may have slightly different, variations of the virus. And so putting that back together becomes a trickier proposition, but it's certainly possible.
UW-Milwaukee's Ryan Newton and Sandra McClellan, their faculty in the School of Freshwater Sciences, were learning how wastewater sampling allows for testing for the coronavirus's presence, looking at how it changes, it mutates. What do you want to know about tracking the pathogen's spread through feces? If this was done widely, would it be an invasion of privacy? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute. Pick this up here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Testing wastewater answers the simple question of whether or not the coronavirus is present in a given community. And scientists now around the country and world want more widespread testing of sewage to help predict the spread of the virus. And there's talk about building a new national surveillance program. Would you support a national effort to monitor and test sewage? What do you want to know about the limits of wastewater detection? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We have UW-Milwaukee's Sandra McClellan and Ryan Newton, who are faculty in the School of Freshwater Sciences, and they've been analyzing sewage, explaining their results. Let's go to Tim now in Verona. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question is to do with the privately sewered districts and kind of the inability to actually test those because they're private. And it's interesting that you can test the larger facilities, but there has to be a kind of a skewed result because of if you're testing large facilities in close proximity, people living in close proximity, then that number is skewed compared to folks, possibly skewed, the folks that are living in the rural communities that have privately sewered septic systems.
Tim, thank you. Sandra?
Tim, that's a great question. We are working with people all around the country, and my colleague in North Carolina, Rachel Noble, is dealing with this exact question. And across North Carolina, they have many small wastewater treatment plants. So I'm lucky. I have, you know, maybe 8 samples that come into the lab on a single day, and I can capture millions of people and get some data from that. She has to analyze 40 samples, and that doesn't even capture what you're referring to, people who have private on-site disposal systems. So in those cases, you know, we have talked about how, you know, how can we extrapolate that? And it really comes down to then, you know, you do need to test individuals and do maybe random testing or, you know, or some kind of other public health surveillance to understand what's going on in rural areas. That said, you know, also in rural areas, you have less congestion, people are a little bit more spread out. So we kind of expect different rates of spread or different occurrence in rural areas, at least, you know, for that initial, you know, if there's kind of a big spike. But eventually, it does trickle into those areas. And that's what we really want to try and understand. So I don't have a good answer on what people do, you know, in areas that aren't sewered at all. But certainly in the smaller communities, tracking the smaller wastewater treatment plants would help understand the dynamic in a rural area versus an urban area.
Ryan, what have you learned so far from the samples you've collected earlier this year?
Oh, yeah. So for Milwaukee anyway, because that's the majority of samples that we've tested, and I'll let Sandra chime in here in a second too, because she knows a bit more about this. A lot of what we're doing, we're sort of at the limits of our method. So the amount of virus that we're detecting in the sewage system has been pretty close to about our detection capabilities. So we are detecting it in sewage. But because Milwaukee had been for some time at sort of a stasis level, we haven't seen any large spikes in the samples that we processed.
Sandra?
Yeah, we have samples that go all the way back to March, and we really have to thank the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District for partnering with us. Like the day we thought of this idea, they were on board with sending us samples, and we've archived that all the way back. And, you know, we're in a really unique time in science where usually you work out a method, you optimize it, and then you run the method. We're having to run the method side by side with optimizing it. So we don't just do one test. We do it 8 different ways because we think we can make it more sensitive. So we've really worked with samples, as Ryan said, in this period where it's really died out. People have been, isolating, and there's been a lot of social distancing. So now that we have kind of this optimized method, we're going to go back to those samples in April and March and maybe get a picture of what was going on then. So stay tuned for maybe, you know, getting more data from the beginning. But at this point in time, what we're seeing in the Milwaukee, also Brown County and Racine, it is detectable, but it's at low levels. So that gives us a baseline to start with. If cases do start to spike, we expect to be able to detect that because it is detectable in sewage, and we'll watch that on a weekly basis.
Sandra McClellan is here, microbiologist. Ryan Newton studies microbial ecology. They're from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the presence of the coronavirus in sewage. Let's bring in another call now. Bob is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering, is this RNA that you're finding, is this active? Can this be infectious? Or can it become that way again?
Ryan, do you want to take that?
It's always possible, but for the most part, people have come to the conclusion that it's unlikely that it is infectious again. We take all precautions that it is infectious, but nobody has shown so far that anything that's moving through the sort of water system, conveyance system of sewage, maintains its integrity and is still infective. And so our best guess is that it is not, but you know, nothing's out of the window. Nothing's off the table, I guess you would say, with this sort of virus.
Bob, thanks for that question. I wonder, Sandra, you know, this wastewater epidemiology, you can say can test millions of people at once in a way, or you know, show, kind of canvas a whole community. But my guess is you can't track the sewage to like a specific nursing home or a specific meatpacking plant. Is that a drawback of this kind of research?
You know, it is. We get a picture of the community, and we could theoretically go up the sewage system because it's a giant network. So if we can isolate parts of the city within the sewage system and get an appropriate sample, theoretically, we could say there's more cases in one part of the city versus the other. But there's a whole lot of kind of wastewater engineering that we need to understand to get the right sample. So it's all in kind of the sample design and collection that would allow us to do that. There has been discussion about monitoring college dorms, nursing homes, that sort of thing. And again, it's kind of a logistic, physical, collect the sample question, more so than detecting the virus. So the bottom line is, if you could get the right kind of sample, theoretically, you could do smaller areas or even buildings, but it's not easy to do that.
Do you have any CDC guidelines, recommendations, any protocols coming down from the CDC on this?
You know, the CDC actually just had a webinar July 8th, just 2 days ago, talking about how, you know, sewage surveillance really is going to be useful and some plans to kind of set up some networks, some surveillance networks where data could maybe be centralized. So we're really looking, this has really taken off. It's only July. And so over 4 months, this science has moved really fast. So I really expect that to be happening over the next couple months. And I want to put a plug in for all my colleagues around the country that work in environmental virology. These are the top people in the nation that have kind of brought all the other scientists on board on getting these methods up and running in their communities. So it's almost been this really kind of good crowdsourcing of science to create these surveillance networks. And now the CDC, the EPA, I think are really jumping in and helping standardize the methods from these grassroots efforts and standardize maybe some of the data reporting.
We only have a few seconds left, Sandra, but what is the next step in building Wisconsin's surveillance network?
You know, it's really about communicating that data and working with the state and the public health officials so we can interpret kind of this complex test and all these nuances to something that they can really take action on.
Well, thank you both for joining us and explaining the research.
Thanks for having us.
Sandra McClellan, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, her colleague Ryan Newton, an assistant professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences. Just ahead, we spend time with award-winning author Avi, who published children's and young adult books about a girl pirates, wild escapes, hidden identities, super friendly mice, so much more. His recent book just came out. It's called Ragweed and Poppy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.